The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this afternoon's session on immigration and national security issues. My name is Bo Cooper. I am an attorney here in town at Paul Hastings, Janofsky & Walker, practicing immigration law. I also teach immigration law at the University of Michigan Law School and spent some time here at AU as a fellow in law and government. Before that, I was in the government myself and spent time, many years in the INS, and was its general counsel from 1999 to 2003. It's a pleasure to join you all here. And I think it was brilliant for the organizers of this event to add this topic to this symposium. Apparently it wasn't a part of the process last year. And I can't imagine an actual thorough debate about international and national security issues without including immigration as one of the core subjects that's got to be grappled with as security issues are parsed through. Immigration has been considered to be a key incident of security policy in this country since the very beginning, since we did have federal immigration laws. Let me read to you what the Supreme Court was saying about this back in the 19th century. To preserve its independence and give security against foreign aggression and encroachment is the highest duty of every nation, and to attain these ends, nearly all other considerations are to be subordinated. And it's this logic that has led the courts and the U.S. government to order its authorities since the 1880s in such a way that the political branches have had virtually unfettered authority to set immigration policy the way that they saw fit, particularly when national security goals were at stake. Before 9/11, certainly in the years just before 9/11, there were important national security issues in the immigration field, but they were of a very, very different flavor. The biggest and most challenging national security issue that I recall from the years immediately post 9/11 involved the question of under what circumstances was it lawful and fair to use classified information in the course of a deportation proceeding or an exclusion proceeding that the person whose interests were at stake in the proceeding wouldn't have access to. This was a massively controversial issue in those years, and the government was taking a serious beating for the way in which it exercised this authority. After 9/11, obviously, the world changed, and everything changed very, very, very dramatically. It became immediately evident, not that this was a total surprise to the government or to immigration policymakers, but it became evident in an extremely brightly spotlit way that we as a government didn't have any reliable, methodical way of knowing that when people came here in temporary admissions that they left when it was time to go, or knowing what they were doing during those periods of temporary admissions. It became painfully clear that the government, the various government entities with shared portfolios weren't nearly as good as they needed to have been at sharing relevant information, and at sharing information that would have been critical to various governmental decisions, including in the immigration context. It became abundantly clear that our system had major vulnerabilities that were wide open to exploitation in ways that we'll hear a lot more about this afternoon. And since that time, and there's never been a quiet time in the immigration field in the 15 years that I've been involved in it, but since that time there's just been a blizzard of policy changes in the U.S. immigration front designed to close these gaps that became so grievously exposed in the wake of 9/11. I think at this point there are a number of questions that we ought to focus on as we explore this question of immigration and national security. The first one obviously has got to be what gaps remain, what security gaps remain in our immigration policy, and what prospects do we have reasonably for closing those gaps? The second one, I think, needs to be, are there ways in which we've overdone it, in which we've put in place policies that skewed the balance between our need, our imperative for national security, and the need to respect individual liberties without an adequate security gain? Are there ways in which we put in place security policies that have impeded, without an adequate security gain, the facilitation of travel into this country that we consider valuable, the travel into this country of students, of scientists, business persons and investors, of cultural exchange visitors? Are there ways in which our security policies have impeded that flow in a way that has disserved the nation? The next question I think we need to focus on is this. Congress is smack in the middle of a debate over a wider reform of our immigration system. And that debate has focused principally on changes to enhance border security, changes to ensure that people who are not authorized to work cannot work in this country, and therefore to control against the huge tide of illegal immigration that we've seen. And then the third thing is, and the most controversial part of the immigration reform debate is, should there be a large-scale worker program that provides some lawful status to the estimated 12 million people who are here unlawfully, and that provides for a future flow of people into the U.S. to exercise roles in our economy, in our labor force that Americans are thought not to want to fulfill in adequate numbers. And so it's imperative that we, in the course of that policy debate, try to consider to what extent and how should national security issues inform how that debate comes out. And the last question I think we ought to focus on is a structural one. The Department of Homeland Security was built on the idea that better structure would make for better government, and that the way to do that was to gather up all these agencies with shared interests and common fields under one roof so that their activities could be better coordinated. In the immigration field, the thinking immigration, of course, came into the Department of Homeland Security. But in the immigration field, there was actually a countercurrent of thinking at the same time. That is that at the same time, so many agencies were being brought into a single agency to be better coordinated, the single immigration agency was separated into three. The idea being that it was schizophrenic to expect one agency to both enforce immigration laws against those who should not be welcome in this country and to provide immigration benefits to those who should. And that those functions ought to be split, and then there were additional splits. And I think now is a good time, nearly half a decade after 9/11, passing 3 years actually since the beginning of the Department of Homeland Security. Are we more effective at security in immigration because of the Department of Homeland Security? And if so, what have been the successes? And conversely, are there any gaps that remain? Or ways in which that's not been as successful as we would like in the effective administration of immigration policy. We've got a terrific panel here to explore these and other thoughts with you this afternoon. Let me introduce them now, and then I'll turn this over to them. The first is Mark Krikorian. Mark is the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization here in town that examines the impact on immigration in the United States. And if you haven't seen Mark, you don't watch the tube, because he has been just about everywhere. He's been on 60 Minutes, on Nightline, the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, CNN, radio, NPR, the print media, Washington Post, New York Times, and the list goes on. And he's been an important policy analyst in this area for many years. The next is another important policy analyst in this area, Mr. Dan Griswold. Dan is the director of the Cato Institute's Center for Trade Policy Studies, and he likewise has been a very public and very compelling participant in this policy debate. He's been published in major newspapers and has appeared in television and radio news and talk shows. He's braved Lou Dobbs tonight. He's been on C-SPAN, Fox News, and has testified many times in Congress, as has Mark. Finally, we have a key participant in the Homeland Security apparatus joining us, someone that I had the pleasure of working with a great deal when I was in the Department of Homeland Security, Mr. Bob Shook. And Bob is the Deputy Assistant Director for National Security Investigations. Bob had been with the INS for a long time, since 1992, where he was an investigator, a special agent in San Francisco. And his talents were recognized early, and he was quickly hoisted up the ladder. And has most recently been the Deputy Assistant Director for ICE's Immigration and Customs Enforcement's National Security Investigations Division. There he's coordinated dozens of national security operations. And Bob was just month before last chosen for a very prestigious position, the Special Agent in Charge, or the Chief Operational Officer for ICE in Los Angeles, California. It's a terrific panel. I look very forward to hearing what they've got to share with us. And Mark, would you please start us off?
Thank you, Bo, and thanks for the invitation to speak here. Thanks particularly to John Feary, who's invited me, and I was happy to come and appear. All of our publications, by the way, for those of you who are interested in like or hate what you hear after I finish, are at cis.org, our website, cis.org. As Bo said, immigration policy has been viewed in the, through the prism of national security for a long time. When the predecessors to the INS was set up, it was originally in the Labor Department, actually the Department of Commerce and Labor, and then when it was split up, it was moved to the Labor Department. In 1940, though, as war approached, it was moved, the Immigration and Naturalization Service is what it was called already at that point, was moved to the Justice Department for specifically for reasons of what we would now call Homeland Security. The thing is that in the past, when people talked about threats to the homeland, they used the image of the home front, but mainly they used it metaphorically. In other words, the home front, an image coined in World War I but used widely in World War II, really wasn't intended to be taken literally. It was a way to motivate civilians to turn in their tires for recycling and stop griping about butter rationing. But the home front today is the primary front that we are faced with. In other words, all the activity in on other fronts is at least intended to serve the purpose of securing the home front. And my point here is that the difference between the role that immigration policy played in a security sense in the past and today is that now the threat that immigration policy is supposed to meet is a permanent and systemic threat in the modern security environment. Asymmetric threats to the United States are never going away. And there are a whole variety of forms of asymmetric warfare. We saw that with the bombing of our embassies in East Africa, the bombing of the coal, et cetera. But since 9/11, it's clear that the brass ring of asymmetric conflict is mass casualty civilian attacks against our homeland. Nor is this strictly an issue of radical Islam. If and when the threat from radical Islam fades or recedes, we're still going to face forever in the modern security environment issues that need to be dealt with through immigration policy. If, for instance, the state fails in Colombia and we get sucked into a war against the FARC or whoever it ends up we're shooting at, asymmetric threats against our homeland are going to be an important consideration. If North Korea invades South Korea, in addition to artillery barrages against Seoul, the North Korean regime is going to, presumably already has, if they have any sense, planned out attacks on our supermarkets and our oil pipelines. Likewise, God forbid if we get involved in a war with China over Taiwan. So this is not simply an issue of radical Islam, although clearly that's what we're facing today. The reason immigration is central, it's kind of obvious, but you sort of have to say it over and over again, is that the enemy can't commit mass casualty attacks against civilians in our homeland if they can't get into our homeland. We looked at 48 Al-Qaeda operatives from 93 through the 9/11 attacks to see what they did, what their immigration histories were, and we found that they had taken advantage of every aspect, every weakness in our immigration system. About a third of them were temporary visitors, here on non-immigrant visas, they're called technically. A third of them were here on green cards or had already gotten U.S. citizenship. And about a third of them were illegal aliens, some of whom were had pending asylum claims. So every aspect of our immigration policy had been penetrated by the enemy. Now, the response, the immigration response to this asymmetric threat, as far as I see it, needs to have two parts. We focused on the first a lot, and I'll talk about that, but also the second. The first part is the mechanism of immigration control, better immigration controls, better enforcement, the stuff that Bo was referring to, actually trying to know who's here and whether they've left when they were supposed to leave and all of that stuff. But also the second part of our immigration, the second part of a security strategy related to immigration policy is immigration numbers and whether there's an actual, whether there are security consequences of the actual level of immigration. Let me talk about the first one, the plumbing, the mechanism of immigration control. It can never be hermetic. Often concerns about immigration vulnerabilities, security concerns, are dismissed by saying, well, you know, some people can always sneak through. We can never keep out every bad guy from crossing the Mexican border or getting a visa to come into the United States or what have you, and that's true. But I don't know about you, but I lock my door at night, even though I know that there are people who can pick that lock. There are people who can still steal my car or get into my house, but security is not about perfection. It's about raising the odds or reducing the odds for bad guys to penetrate your security measures. And we can, in fact, use immigration policy and have successfully used immigration policy to harass and disrupt enemy attempts to attack us. And the first temptation, the first inclination of a lot of people who are resistant to the idea that there are security implications to immigration policy is to try to focus the new concern about immigration enforcement on specific elements of immigration law or specific people. In short, keep out all the Arabs. I mean, that's sort of the knee-jerk reaction, and I don't just mean in a bar in Baltimore, I mean in the government itself. Focus enforcement on Muslims, and in the short term, that might actually make sense as a kind of triage. Right after 9/11, it probably did make sense to do that. In the long term, it can't work. You can't have a system that lets in the good illegal alien busboy but keeps out the bad illegal alien terrorist. Now, the components of the control part of better immigration control are threefold. There's three levels as far as I see it, overseas, at the border, and inside the country. The first two we've had a lot of action on, a lot of activity on. The third we've actually not done very well on. Overseas, the issue there is visas. Does the State Department do a good job of screening visa applicants and refusing people who shouldn't be getting visas? And the answer is it's doing better than it used to be. We've actually put a good deal of effort into that. There are some serious systemic problems in having the State Department issue visas, because their concern is not security. Their institutional goal is diplomacy rather than security. And so I'd have to say that we still have a significant problem in that Foreign Service officers are the ones making visa decisions instead of Homeland Security employees. Nonetheless, we have, in fact, at least attempted to move forward there and done a little better than we used to. Then the next level is the border. There are two parts to border issues. One is the ports of entry, in other words, the land crossings or the airports or seaports where people are formally inspected and admitted to the United States, and then the area between those ports of entry, which the Border Patrol and the Coast Guard are responsible for. And again, we've made some advances there. It's a mixed bag, but the Border Patrol, starting actually more than a decade ago, has experienced a significant buildup. It's about double the size it was 10 years ago. It does a better job than it used to. It's still laughably inadequate, but less laughably inadequate than it was a decade ago. At the ports of entry, again, we've attempted to make some advances. There's a U.S. visit system is the jargon in the term. It's essentially an attempt at creating a check-in, check-out system for visitors from overseas. You might have thought we had such a thing. We didn't. In 1996, it was mandated, and it languished, and only after 9/11 did we see some real progress, and even now the job is only half done, not even half done. People are checked in when they come in much more than they used to be, although Mexicans and Canadians are not, but there's no element of the check-out system. And just as a funny story here, it used to be the way we did this check-in, check-out system. You won't believe this, but it used to be two little pieces of paper, 994 form. You filled it out in duplicate when you were a foreign visitor coming to the United States, gave half to the inspector, kept the other half in your passport. And you gave it to the stewardess on the way out. And as you can imagine, people lost them. They weren't collected sometimes. The airlines didn't submit them to immigration. Immigration didn't submit it to the contractor. The contractor may have forgotten to give it to the guy, minimum wage person in Kentucky, using his two fingers to type in the information. So it was a completely worthless system of tracking the arrival and departure of foreign visitors. We're trying to modernize that and bring it at least into the 20th century, if not the 21st. I'm not going to beat up on the bureaucrats because the bureaucrats aren't the problem here, but the point is that progress is being made, but it's slow. The third area is interior enforcement, and there we've actually, in my opinion, backslid. The interior enforcement involves three components: deportations. Last year, we only deported 41,000 people from actually inside the United States. It's actually down about 20% or so from the previous year. There's also firewalls, what I call firewalls. In other words, attempting to make it impossible to live a normal life here. That's both for ordinary illegal aliens as well as for bad guys of various kinds. The point is to disrupt them and make it hard to conduct your business here if you don't have legal status. That involves things like enforcing the ban on hiring illegal aliens, which we have all but abandoned. In 2004, the Government Accountability Office found that only three employers in the entire United States had been fined for the knowing employment of illegal immigrants. And this is not something that just started in 9/11. This is something that started under the Clinton administration when the ban on hiring illegals, the enforcement of it, was abandoned. It was announced in the New York Times, actually. It is the decline in enforcement has continued since then. And the third part, I'll wrap it up quickly here. And this will relate, though, to what Dan is going to say. The third part of interior enforcement is the provision of services. In other words, vetting applicants for green cards, for employment authorization documents, citizenship. People don't see that as an enforcement thing. Bo had referred to how the service and enforcement sides of the old INS were something that was sort of different. In fact, the service provision is an enforcement function. It gives us an additional bite at the apple, an additional filter each time an alien tries to attain a higher status, from illegal to temporary, from temporary to permanent, from permanent to citizen. Each of those gives a bad guy more freedom of action, more ability to attack us, and we need to use that as a screen. And the contention of a lot of supporters of a legalization program is that we will do just that with the 12 million illegals who are here, that we will now start screening them, shrink the haystack that the needle is in, so we can focus better on the real security threats. My problem is the Immigration Service, and again, I'm not beating up on the bureaucrats, but they are choking on immigration. They are completely incapable. The administrative capacity does not exist to screen and vet and track the existing workload that the Immigration Service, the USCIS, which is the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, that they have to deal with. The idea that 12 million extra applications dumped in their mailbox over a 12-month period is somehow going to successfully be screened is fantasy. I'll talk about the second part, the numbers issue, later if you want in questions, but the basic point I want to leave you with is that when you play a game, you only win if you have offense and defense. We've got a lot of offense. Some of it may be a good idea, some of it may not. I'm not going to render any opinions about the Iraq war or anything else, but our defensive game has been almost laughably inadequate. And we're going to pay for it unless we start boosting our defensive efforts. And specifically, immigration control is the most important aspect of that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mark. Dan Griswold.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. First, I'd like to thank the National Security and Law Society and John Fiore for inviting me to be here. And it's kind of fun to have Bo Cooper moderating. I remember about 1998, I was moderating an event at Cato, and Bo was one of the speakers. So, nice little turnaround here. Let me just say first, I'm with the Cato Institute. Cato is a nonprofit educational think tank. Our guiding principles are individual liberty, free markets, limited government, peace among nations. We've long taken a favorable view of immigration. We think immigration has been one of the reasons America is such a successful, dynamic society, and economy. And I guess the thrust of my message today is we don't need to commit economic suicide to have secure borders. We can have both robust immigration and secure borders and a secure homeland. Let me just spend a minute or two talking about how we got into the illegal immigration mess, because I think that has lots of implications for national security, and we can, if we solve that, we'll actually be more secure and can get more of a handle on our national security issue. We basically have illegal immigration because, one, it comes down to demand and supply, like so many things. We have continued demand in this country for low-skilled workers. We're creating hundreds of thousands of jobs each year. We all know what those jobs are in retail and gardening and other services and construction. At a time when the American workforce is getting older, I can vouch for that. We're getting better educated. The 40 years ago, believe it or not, more than half of the adults in the American workforce did not have a high school degree. Today, that's 10% and dropping. So you have this structural gap between the demand for low-skilled workers and the supply here in the United States. And yet there's no certain legal channel for a peaceful, hardworking person from Mexico or some other country to come into the United States and take these jobs. So we have large-scale illegal immigration coming across the border. We have tried enforcement. We've made a good stab at enforcement in the last 15 years. We've increased spending on border security tenfold on the Border Patrol since the late 1980s, line watch hours up eightfold, this interior enforcement, and we've made a try at enforcing interior enforcement. Back in 1999, we busted 400 companies and thousands of workers. It didn't make a dent in the issue. You remember there was a long case where the Homeland Security Department busted 300 janitors who were working for contractors for Walmart. Now, 300 down, 7 million to go. It's just not making a dent in it. We think the only way to approach this is some kind of legalization program, a comprehensive immigration reform like President Bush has been talking about. Take those 90%+, take that busboy, let him come in legally in a regular port of entry. He's not a national security threat. He just wants to come here to work, send money back home. Let's let him do it. We need the work. He's willing to work. He's not a national security threat. And I'll talk about how that would make defending our borders more practical. I think everybody on the panel agrees that the first duty of government is protecting the homeland, protecting American citizens from threats, foreign and domestic. And border security is an important challenge, an important part of that line of defense. The challenge confronting us is how to have an immigration policy, a border security policy that serves our national interest, our economic interest, our values as a nation, and at the same time keeps us secure. I think we can do it. After September 11th, some of the critics of immigration came out very loudly and said, see, this is what our immigration policy has gotten us. They tried to put the focus on immigrants coming into the United States, and I think they confused the debate in a very important way. There is a difference. We've talked a lot about immigration policy, but the vast majority of foreign-born people who come to the United States every year don't come as immigrants. In the last fiscal year, 31 million different foreign-born people entered the United States. 31 million, just remember that number. And some of those came in multiple times, so that on a typical day, 1 million people enter the United States from abroad. Some of them are American citizens, but about 700,000 of them are foreign-born people entering the United States every day. That is where the terrorists came in. You know, not a single one of the September 11th hijackers came across the Mexican border. That's just not the way they came. Why go through the risk when you can buy a ticket and fly into JFK? Those 48 terrorists that Mark mentioned, and I read that study, I don't believe a single one of them came across the Mexican border. They all came in through a normal legal port of entry. They may have become illegal after that, but basically they did not come across the Mexican border, and yet that has been the focus, I might say the obsession, of U.S. Immigration and border security policy over the last 20 years is keeping that busboy, keeping a gardener, keeping a dishwasher, a construction worker out of the United States. In a typical year, About 1.3, 1.4, 1.5 million people do come to the United States and settle permanently. About half of them legally, about half of them illegally. But if you compare that to that 31 million people coming in, only about 5% of the people entering the United States each year immigrate in any sense of the word. So it's not an immigration problem, it's a border security problem. And yet again, up until September 11th and then after that, our overriding focus seemed to be keeping people out who, heaven forbid, might come here to work. I think that's a misuse of our resources. It's just plain wrong to say that Homeland Security begins at our borders. It begins far beyond our borders, in the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan, at our consulates abroad, at the headquarters of our intelligence and military abroad. The challenge is to stop, to identify, apprehend, and stop terrorists well before they get anywhere near our border. If they're in Mexico or Canada or flying on a plane to the United States, we've missed the boat. That's too late. We should try to stop them before they get here. Now, it would be foolish, I believe, to focus all our security resources on the southwest border. First, Mexicans themselves are not a national security threat. They almost universally come here to work. There are petty criminals in there, but they're not terrorists in the sense that we're talking about today. Second, international terrorists have not viewed the southwestern border as a preferred means of entry. In effect, while we were guarding the back door in September 2001, the terrorists came waltzing in through the front door on legal, with legal papers. I think Congress took the right approach in May of 2002. We don't say this very often at the Cato Institute, but they passed a good piece of legislation then, the Enhanced Border Security and Visa Entry Reform Act. It passed overwhelmingly. The bill was signed into law by the president. It requires tamper-proof biometric visas and passports, forwarding of passenger manifests, better tracking of student visas, the establishment of a database of suspected terrorists. How's that for a concept? And the different agencies talking to each other. In short, the law seeks to close our border to terrorists while keeping it open to people who come here to work, to study, to visit. And I think all these common sense provisions in hindsight very well could have prevented September 11th, or at least complicated it. And I agree with Mark, we'll never have a perfect defense, but we should do all we can to make it at least more difficult. And I think members of Congress rightly understood then, maybe less so now, that Mexican migration is not a threat to national security. Indeed, legalizing Mexican migration along the lines of what the president's talking about would actually enhance our security in several important ways. One, we would start to drain the swamp of smuggling and document fraud that creates a kind of channel for terrorists to come into the country. If we had a legalization program where the 90%+ of the people coming across our border who have no criminal records, no criminal intentions, if they could come in a safe, orderly, legal way, we could concentrate our firepower on those who are coming in to do us harm. It would put a huge dent in the profits of the smuggling operations. You'd have less document fraud and other things going on. In effect, you'd start to drain the swamp, drain the sea in which these people swim. You'd also encourage millions of people who are here illegally to come forward and register. Most of them, the large majority of them, are not a security threat themselves, but they're afraid to cooperate with law enforcement. It's a national security issue to have 12 million people here who we don't know who they are. They're afraid to cooperate with law enforcement and local police. They're keeping a lot of cash around because they can't, in some cases, open up a bank account. Wouldn't it be better if they were here legally than illegally? We're not going to send them home overnight in some kind of biblical exodus. One, it would be a humanitarian and economic disaster, but it would just be impractical. I think Congress should respond to the leadership shown by President Bush, Senator McCain, Senator Cornyn, and others, and pass some kind of guest worker program, if you want to call it that, temporary worker program. I think then we would have a better chance. You know, how would you rather have our Homeland Security Department expending its resources? Chasing down terrorists and putting them in jail, or busting janitors at a discount store? I have my preference how I'd like them to use their resources. You know, we have an example in history of how a legalization program can cut down illegal immigration. In the 1950s, we had a very similar problem. We had large-scale incursions across our border of workers coming to the United States. We had a program called the Bracero Program. President Eisenhower and the Congress at the time dramatically raised the number of visas under that program. And I'm not saying we should copy that program. It had some fatal flaws. But at least it created that legal channel. You know what happened to illegal immigration, at least the apprehensions across the border? It fell dramatically. And I think that is an important lesson for us. The so-called border security bill that the House passed in December, and I think certain provisions of that were wise, and I think when combined with some kind of legalization program is probably the answer. But one, they basically would declare the 11 or 12 million people here illegally as felons. Don't our law enforcement people have enough to do chasing down rapists and robbers and terrorists without having to apprehend gardeners and construction workers? Secondly, they've appropriated more than $1 billion for a 700-mile wall, and all our enforcement efforts have done so far is just divert the flow of people further out in the desert where they're actually more likely to get in, more likely to die, and more likely to stay here once they're in. Does this Congress need to spend billions more on walls to nowhere that will have no positive effect? I'm down to 0 minutes. I will just say, and I'm on my concluding paragraph, we can waste billions of dollars raiding chicken processing plants and discount stores, building walls to nowhere, stationing troops on the border, or we can enact a sensible legalization program which will make us more secure, enhance our economy, and I believe live up to the great traditions of this country. Thank you very much.
Dan, thanks very much. Rob Schiff from the Department of Homeland Security.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the invitation to speak, John, and thank you for your indulgence and your time this afternoon. I guess this is the end of nearing the end of your conference, so I'll try to make this as exciting as I can. I've heard it mentioned about playing offense and defense. I guess I'm the one in ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that is responsible for drawing up the actual plays so that I can try to work both offense and defense, because they are both important parts in our efforts. As many other aspects of business, government, and everyday life, the focus on immigration obviously changed following 9/11, the horrific acts that were committed on 9/11. We weren't just, before I think it was looked at, the threat was the persons coming in and exploiting our economic and our societal structure, if you will, in the United States. Following 9/11, now the threat was really kind of the new paradigm was the person themselves coming in to destroy that very economy and the society that we all must protect. Immigration issues such as overstays, visa fraud, asylum fraud were previously recognized as problems, but I don't think anybody saw them as precursors or vulnerabilities that could be exploited by people that want to do harm, inflict harm on us, and obviously go undetected while they're planning to carry out horrific acts against the homeland. On March 1st, 2003, the Homeland Security Act provision to merge the criminal investigations divisions of the U.S. Customs Service, which was under the Department of Treasury, and under the Department of Justice to merge the Immigration and Naturalizations Office of Investigations went into effect. But what was significant was it went into effect under the Department of Homeland Security with the expectation that we would be doing something new to protect the homeland following, obviously, the horrific acts of 9/11. With these new combined authorities, both from Immigration and Customs, ICE really, and its nearly 6,000 special agents, has become, I think, a key player in the war on terrorism. For example, we use now our many tools to fight terrorist financing. We have actually used and implemented a comprehensive investigative approach under the Patriot Act. We have some new authorities to go after unlicensed money brokers and look at ways that the terrorist or criminal organizations earn, move, and store their assets. In addition to financial expertise, we have the broadest authority when it comes to export violations, from the Arms Export Control Act to some provisions that deal with dual-use technology, military parts. Those specific violations, we have the broadest authority to investigate. Also, we look at the vulnerabilities in our border security exploited by alien smugglers. We go after those organizations today using our financial expertise, and we seize money and other assets used by those organizations to really cripple those organizations. We prioritize immigration benefit fraud, from asylum fraud to other various forms of fraud. And we also have 56 foreign offices, because these crimes transcend borders. There are violations internationally. There are suspects, targets internationally, that we use our 56 offices, our attachés, to help us to investigate these crimes. In addition to carrying out the traditional immigration and customs investigations from our legacy agencies, ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, actually launched an initiative, and this was actually carried out mainly by our National Security Investigations Division, which I run, and really looking at the specific vulnerabilities that were exploited by the 9/11 conspirators, and other vulnerabilities as well that are also ripe for other terrorists or criminals to exploit. This really was in direct response to the major findings following the 9/11 attacks. Specifically, the 9/11 Commission, in its final report, found that had the immigration system set a higher bar for determining whether individuals are who or what they claim to be, and ensuring routine consequences for violations, it could have excluded, removed, or come into further contact with several hijackers who did not appear to meet the terms of their admitting short-term visitors, visas. ICE's robust post 9/11 focus really looked at the immigration systems in those areas that were exploited by the 9/11 hijackers. Accordingly, in June 2003, myself and a really good group of team that was detailed into ICE headquarters developed and initiated the Compliance Enforcement Unit, the first national program of its kind. It was created to specifically enforce non-immigrant violations, including those from CVIS, which I'll talk about in a minute, and U.S. Visit, which I think one of the panelists spoke about earlier. Roughly 50 new headquarters positions, 238 new investigator field special agents are now deployed over the past 2 years to investigate routine immigration violations. The national program has reviewed a total of 350,000 leads, with 12,000 investigative leads going out to these special agents to further investigate. Had the CEU program been in place prior to 9/11, six of the hijackers would have been identified and selected for further investigation into their routine immigration violations. I mentioned CVIS. CVIS is the Student Exchange Visa, Visitor Information System that was put in place it started under INS, and then it was fully implemented under ICE. With the full implementation of the system in about midway through 2003, we now for the first time have a system in place that can accurately track foreign students in a non-intrusive manner. If you hadn't heard this in some of the other discussions that have taken place or been in the print media, there were approximately 70,000 schools sponsoring students for entry prior to 9/11. With the full inauguration of CVIS, that number went down to 7,000 accredited schools that were authorized. And now we actually conduct on-site visits to the facilities to ensure these are legitimate accredited schools that can apply for foreign students to come to this country. In a relatively short existence, ICE's compliance enforcement has developed basically a whole number of cases and identified high-risk visa violators. We've also created a threat analysis section. We call it looking under the radar, people that aren't known to the U.S. government or to other governments abroad, and looking at ways we might be able to make connections in our databases to identify these people. Other programs I think are significant. We look at the World Trade Center bombings, the first World Trade Center bombings, and there were immigration fraud, various immigration fraud violations committed then. We have an aggressive fraud program now that looks at that, that works with the Citizenship Immigration Service, focusing on those systemic vulnerabilities. We also create a visa security program, which is now operated by our Office of International Affairs, establishes a forward-based defense looking at the, and working hand-in-hand with the Department of State to make sure that, that we agree with the visas that are being issued are issued to those people that deserve them. Also, I want to point out that we have a forensic document lab, again, former INS, the transition now into ICE, that also is looking at documents, looking at any document maybe in question for national security, and seeing how we might be able to get those trends out to the line inspectors with Customs Border Protection to make sure that they're aware of anything that might be nefarious trends and so forth with travel documents. And lastly, our Joint Terrorism Task Force participation. We have, I have, for anybody who would like it, 25 different cases that we put together that really, I think, underscore the power of immigration, how it can help us in this effort in the war on terrorism. We have, second only to the FBI, who actually runs the Joint Terrorism Task Force, we have the largest contribution ICE does to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Last year alone, we had over 300 arrests, national security arrests, on the task force for charges from traditional immigration violations like harboring aliens, visa fraud, asylum fraud, to those involving bulk cash smuggling or the illegal exportation of arms. It really, for somebody, and I think Mr. Cooper pointed out how I had a history with INS before folding into the ICE structure on March 1st of 2003. I'm excited for what we have done in the last 3 years. I often think that the message doesn't get out often in the department at my level on the encouraging steps that we've taken, some of the offense and the defense we are playing, some of the initiatives. And I'm really excited that what we're doing, how we're doing it, we are making, I think, an effort and trying to do things as Congress asked us to do in an improved way following 9/11. And I look forward to any questions that you all may have, and again, the opportunity to speak here today. Thank you.
Bob, Dan, Mark, thank you all very much. Now we'd like to invite your comments, questions, challenge us if you disagree, probe if you think we glossed over things. John. Yeah, and if you've got questions, I'd appreciate it if you could step up to the mic and identify yourself and your affiliation.
John Curry, student here at WCL. Just a basic question. What do each one of the panelists think about the other panelists have to say today? Any differences in opinion?
Should I?
I thought Mark was pretty tame.
Well, I don't know. I went first, so I'll go first with the answer. I'm actually very encouraged by what Bob said. I still fear, though, that what happened with the combination of the investigators from Customs and the investigators from Immigration is that it wasn't so much a merger as an acquisition, and it was INS was acquired by the Customs Service. And so immigration enforcement, I've heard from people in the field, immigration enforcement has become increasingly a tool used by the Customs people to go after money launderers and others, in a sort of along the same lines that you'd go after, you know, Treasury went after Al Capone for not paying his taxes because it was the easier thing to stick him with. But when that happened, there was always a bureau within Treasury whose whole job was enforcing nothing but tax laws. What we have now is that there no longer exists a bureaucracy whose whole reason for existence is enforcing routine immigration laws. Bob's comments about some efforts in that regard are encouraging, but nonetheless, the institutional dynamic is such that it's now nobody's job, sole reason for existence, to enforce immigration laws, and that's what I was concerned about. And I mean, from what Dan and I have been doing this a long time, the contention that that the Immigration Service, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Service, is capable of successfully screening 12 million people and vetting them and tracking them is almost absurdly unrealistic. In fact, after we do all of that, we're not going to have any better idea who they are than before we did. We tried that in 1986. Congress passed a big amnesty. We amnestied almost 3 million people. Up to 70% of them were fraudulent. Hundreds of thousands of people lied about having worked on farms. They asked them, well, you know, you pick watermelons, really, that's good. How did you pick the watermelons? Well, we climbed up the ladders and picked them off the watermelon trees. I mean, these people had no concept. They were lying through their teeth. And the political dynamic was such, and exactly the same as it will be today, that those people got legal status, that they will get it again today. And when you do that, you empower those illegal aliens who want to do us harm because they now have legal status. And it's bad enough to have an illegal alien terrorist in your country. It's much worse if he can come and go freely because he has legal status, like, I don't know, Mahmoud Abu Halima, who got a green card as a farm worker, even though he was a cabbie in New York, and only because he got his green card as a result of the last amnesty was he able to go to Afghanistan, get his terrorist training, and help lead the first World Trade Center attack.
Yeah, let me respond to that, because I don't see the administrative hurdles as being as daunting as Mark does. One, we're already processing 1 million people a day who are entering. 31 million different people entered the United States last year, in the last fiscal year. I think we can process 12 million on a kind of rolling basis. It wouldn't all be on a week from Tuesday. And secondly, I think we would be more secure. We're somewhat wiser than we were in 1986 about who's here, and I don't think we'd have the same process. I think it would be better for our national security to vet those people, to know who they are, to make them legal, and if they don't come forward and register them, I think we'd have a better chance of getting them than if they're swimming in this sea of 12 million unknown people. They're not going to go home. Mark knows that. I know that. We're not going to deport these 12 million people overnight. I'd feel much more secure if we knew who those people were. We could vet them, and I think we would have a much better system than we had back then. I think the 70% fraudulent figures significantly higher than what it was. There was some fraud, but it wasn't 70%.
This is the one issue where the Cato Institute has great confidence in the ability of the federal government to do its job. I'm very touched. Sorry.
John, you asked about disagreement. I actually agree with Mark that there would be a lot of bureaucratic challenges to trying to implement a program that gave legal status to 12 million people. There'd be massive bureaucratic challenges. But I do question, though, why that's decisive of the issue whether or not to have a program, because I wonder why the same operational limits wouldn't impede our ability to march them all home, even if that were our will or if we could sustain the economic consequences.
It would be. And Dan was right about it being impractical to deport 12 million people. It's not going to happen because the capacity doesn't exist. Even if we wanted to do it, we couldn't do it, and we wouldn't want to do it because it would be disruptive having incorporated all these people, having gotten addicted to the labor. But those aren't the only two choices. See, this is the way it's presented. Either we magically deport everybody tomorrow, or we magically screen and vet and background check everybody tomorrow and legalize them, or even over a period of 12 months, because that's what it would be. It's a 12-month or even 6-month period that the law, that the proposals require. Neither one of those things is real. Those are both magical results of magical thinking. It can't happen successfully. What we can do, and which doesn't require magical thinking, is try to have a strategy of attrition of the illegal population. So we use whatever resources we happen to have with whatever legal tools we happen to have and start and engineer a turnaround in the illegal population so that instead of growing each year, it starts shrinking each year. You back out of a problem that took years to get into. Then when it's smaller, you can then talk about, okay, do we undertake a limited legalization, maybe or maybe not, and let that take as long as it's going to take, without political pressure to wrap it up fast. But my point is, the point is, mass legalization and mass roundups are not the only options available to us.
Just two quick points. You can see Mark and I could go back and forth all day, but I think the attrition approach embodies a lot of magical thinking. It assumes that redoubling our enforcement efforts will stem the inflow of illegals, even though our tenfold increase in enforcement efforts over the last 15 years haven't had any impact. Secondly, you know, there are fees involved here, and bureaucrats respond to incentives like everybody else. You charge $2,000 for registration, and I think the large majority of people here illegally would take the U.S. up on that offer, $2,000 to become legal. Say 10 million legal people, that's $20 billion. You can pay for a lot of administration with $20 billion.
Bob, you haven't disagreed with any of us. You want to take that invitation before we move on to the next question?
He's not allowed to disagree, agree or disagree.
My question is OG and part of the Mexicans. And Leo Santiago testified in front of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee
and said that when they encounter someone who is an OTM, there's not anyone who can translate the words that these people are saying to the USBC agent. And my question to you is there anything being done to make sure that we are identifying these OTMs and making sure that we can put them in a system in a case that we have of a catch and release policy that the United States is having right now?
Thank you. And you can tell me your name?
My name is Zachary Lewis.
Zachary, thanks.
I guess I can try to address that. We have, there is the Customs Border Protection deals with those apprehensions at the border. Office of Investigation typically is dealing with other issues, interior issues and border issues, but not so much the volume as our Border Patrol and our inspectors deal with. There are efforts underway dealing with expedited removal that deals with now, OTMs, as you call them, as I think it's a term that's used quite often, that I think that they're looking at expanding that ER to apply to those situations, so somebody would actually be held under expedited removal, be mandatory detention for those individuals. And then as far as the systems they're put into, I mean, we have ident systems that have interoperability with the IAFA system of the FBI, and to make sure all those criminal checks and identifying these people. Translation issues, there's services available to the Customs and Border Protection and ICE using translation services to make sure we get the right names, to make sure they know their rights and so forth. So that's really what the way I would address that question.
My concern, first of all, the issue for people get it is that non-Mexicans aren't the only people sneaking across the Mexican border. In fact, terrorists have already snuck across the Mexican border. There's a high-up Hezbollah official who's in jail in Michigan now who was smuggled across the Mexican border by a smuggling ring that included the Mexican government's consul in Beirut. So Mexico is actually becoming an increasingly attractive place to sneak through because we've actually done a little bit better in some of the other places, at our consulates overseas, et cetera. But this issue is the percentage of non-Mexicans that are apprehended is growing. I mean, it used to be something like 2%, 3%. It's now 10, 12%, or at least it was projected to be that for this year or for 2005. I don't know what the number was. My concern is that we are continuing this catch and release program. In other words, we get them, Mexico won't take them back. Mexico takes Mexicans back, won't take non-Mexicans back. So we have to process them for travel and get their visas and stuff. And we just let them go because we don't have anywhere to put them. Now, obviously, they try to do triage. We detain as many as you can, that sort of thing. But they get the ones that we can't hold, they get what they call a diploma. That's what they call it down there. They graduate into the United States, and they have 30 days. They're told to come back in 30 days. Well, they go and get the job in New York or Houston or L.A., and they never come back. Of course they don't. What I want to know is if we can set up tent cities in Guantanamo to hold Cuban and Haitian boat people in large numbers, why aren't we setting up tent cities to detain every single non-Mexican, every one of them starting tomorrow, rather than project the development eventually, maybe this year, maybe next year, of a policy that hopefully will result in none of them being released? That should never have gotten this far. And it's a sign of our frivolous approach at the top levels of the administration and Congress toward immigration security.
I think we can all agree that that's one of the highest duties of government, to keep terrorists out of the country no matter what way they come in, through normal ports of entry, through the Canadian border. And by the way, the Millennium Bomber in December 1999 was coming across the Canadian border, but somehow Congressman Tancredo and others haven't gotten around to building walls on the Canadian border yet, I guess. Mark says it's a matter of time, I guess. I'm not looking forward to that day. But I think there's two things we can do to make it more effective and more likely that we'll apprehend so-called OTMs. And by the way, OTMs, I assume, could be Central Americans, a Guatemalan worker, that sort of thing. He's not a security threat unless he's a gang member. But I think the two things we can do is, one, enact a sensible guest worker program, a legalization program, get those 90-plus percent who are just coming here to work and fill jobs that Americans increasingly don't want. And that would expose those coming across for criminal intention. The second thing, and we haven't talked about it here, but I think more cooperation between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. And I know Mexico has a lot of problems with corruption. They've got a long history to overcome there. But I think some kind of, call it what you want, a common defense perimeter. If the United States, Canada, and Mexico can agree to not let anybody in that either of the other two would not want in. Our perhaps our best natural defense are the two oceans on either side. If we can stop bad people from even landing on the North American continent, make sure that Hamas leader doesn't even enter Mexico, that's, I think, a very important part, and that would make border security at the Mexican border more practical.
Can I make just a quick comment? Because Dan tied together the guest worker issue with the OTM issue, and I think that's important to keep in mind that if we do have a guest worker program, Mexicans are going to rapidly become an increasingly small part of the guest worker flow, because Mexico is an upper middle income country by world standards. If you want really cheap labor, you need to go to Pakistan. You need to go to Egypt, to Bangladesh, to Indonesia. I mean, the guest worker program is essentially, in my opinion, guaranteed to become a Muslim immigration program over a period of 10 or 12 years, because Mexican fertility is falling. Mexico, like I said, is not, I mean, Mexico's already priced out of the labor market by Chinese workers. So that, in other words, factories are leaving Mexico and going to China. So the idea that even a guest worker program will be just Mexico-centric is true only in the very short run.
Let me just respond to that very briefly, because I can't let that go by. There are 100 million Mexicans. It's funny, because most people on Mark's side are always saying the wages are so low in Mexico, there's 100 million of them. Half of Mexico would move here.
Mexicans said that.
Well, they haven't moved here. You know.
That's right, because we had a border patrol keeping them from doing that.
You say the border is porous, and anybody who wants to come through can come through. Well, why haven't 10 million come? But my point is, we can control who comes in. I'm a free trader, but I'm all for a customs service. I'm all for a customs service to keep dangerous goods out of the United States. I think we can let in peaceful, hardworking people, and even more effectively, we don't have any screening now of the 500,000 coming in across the border net each year. If we had a properly designed temporary worker program, we could vet who comes in. We're not going to let in 100,000 workers from Pakistan, I can guarantee that. I don't think there's any basis in reality for what Mark said.
Good afternoon. I'm Jefferson Castro. I'm a judge advocate on activity in the Marine Corps. I have a two-part question, starting with Mr. Corey and working down the panel. I'd like the panel to assess your opinion on the threat of not the bus or the darker country of Mexico, but the rise in narcotics coming through the tunnels, the rise of MS-13 members, whose ideology and criminal behavior is as toxic and corrosive as AQ ever is. What is your assessment of those types of things to national security, threats to national security? The second part of my question is, assess if you would the issues related to federalism, state enforcement, as it relates to thinking outside of the box for state and local governments. Do governors need to mobilize their national guards to round up illegals? Minutemen, good, bad, indifferent. The day worker facility in Herndon, Virginia, just a few miles down the road here. What do you assess as federalism issues? And kind of a corollary to that, what is the precipitating event that you would predict that would require Department of Defense, DOD, no kidding, to mobilize and take some type of affirmative national action to address the immigration problem? Thank you.
And we got 4 minutes, all of us, to answer that one. I mean, I'll go first.
I'll just start with the threat of narcotics, because as you know, with ICE, we have very, very broad jurisdiction to both. We bring the legacy customs that had a tradition for, I'd say probably 25, 30 years of fighting the cartels, and we continue to do that. If you've probably heard about the tunnel that was discovered in San Diego, that was an ICE-led investigation jointly with DA, but ICE-led investigation and information that brought that to light. Those are very much a concern, national security threats. You have NSPD 25 basically saying that narcotics trafficking is a national security threat, and we continue to, it's the same fervor we had before, to enforce and investigate those violations. That tunnel could have been used for narcotics. It could have been used for WMD at the same time. So whatever the right price that somebody's willing, I think, to pay to those organizations, they could have got anything through. Gang members, we also look at as a tremendous threat. We launched Community Shield about a year ago. We just had a second anniversary, and used again our largely in that effort immigration authorities to focus on the MS-13 problem. And in fact, again, thinking outside the box, we actually work with El Salvadorian government to exchange database, to exchange information, intel on members there, members transiting to the U.S. and so forth. And I think we're making a lot of progress in that effort. Hundreds of arrests, dozens of guns, criminal sentences that will be forthcoming, and a number of arrests that we made in that, and I think really adding to the public security in that effort. The state enforcement, I won't get into the military issue. I'll save that for the other panel members, but state enforcement, we have four different states now that we have granted to under 287G, we've granted them with limited immigration authority. They have been trained. They've gone through 10 or 12 weeks of a structured training course, and they've been cross-trained to use immigration authorities under the supervision of ICE, so that any arrests that they anticipate making, that is reviewed by an ICE supervisor. And there is upwards to about 175 of these cross-trained individuals between Florida, Arizona, California, and Alabama. That is, again, another effort to try to meet the demand and enforce the law and give those state authorities limited, with oversight by ICE, the authority to enforce immigration law. And those are the types of things to address some of your questions. Otherwise, I'll take the entire time.
I'll go next, and I'll graciously give Mark the last word. Just to answer in soundbite fashion, but I think the common thread of the four points that I drew out of your question is that if we had a legalization program along the lines of what President Bush is talking about, I think it would make each one of these issues at least more manageable, if not make them disappear entirely. The narcotics trafficking, that's a very complicated issue. I'll just say Cato's produced a lot of literature that has shown a lot of the problems created by our current war on drugs. The war on drugs has dramatically raised profits. Our policy, in effect, has created these cartels the same way Prohibition kind of created the mafia in the 20s and the 30s. So that's a very complicated issue. But I agree that that is an avenue through which terrorism could come into the United States, and I take it seriously. Federalism, I just would come back to my point that don't state and local law enforcement people have enough on their plate with apprehending rapists and murderers and criminals who are out there to commit crimes against us and our families without being enlisted as agents of the INS to fill up our jails with people who are just coming here to work. The Minutemen, they're just a symptom of a dysfunctional system. If we had a sensible, workable guest worker program, the illegal workers, I think, would be replaced by legal workers. The same experience we had in the 50s. We raised legal visas, illegal immigration dropped. A Mexican worker wouldn't come here illegally if they can come here legally and have the privileges that come with that. Finally, putting the military on the border. Again, a legalization program would transform the enforcement question. I don't want the military on our border. It's not what they're trained for. Our military, God bless them, I thank God for them every day, they're trained to kill people. Go out and destroy things, kill people, occupy territory. They're not well suited and well trained for border enforcement. So that's the way I answer those.
Well, let me wrap up, given my thoughts on this. First of all, the MS-13 and other gang issues really highlights how this is not just a Muslim-specific or Arab-specific issue. You get that a lot, and it's important for us to be aware that this is a broader problem that modern technology and modern communications and transportation technology, essentially the shrinking of the world, poses for us. And immigration, we need to, in my opinion, rethink the very premise of immigration policy in modern conditions, both for security and other reasons. I would point, though, to the idea, I mean, there were actually a number of arrests just recently, I think, announced against where ICE was involved in arresting significant numbers of MS-13 terrorists, because, I mean, MS-13 gangers, most of whom, I mean, most of the 18th Street Gang and MS-13 are illegal aliens, and so it's an important tool. The problem is we need to make sure we don't fall into the trap that, like, the NYPD did, in the 70s, where they just went after, they waited for people to commit rape and murder, and they let disorder spread everywhere. Broken windows policing is what reasserted authority in New York, where you didn't wait for big crimes, you reasserted the authority of the state, and that reduced the sense of impunity and lawlessness. That's what we need in immigration matters. In other words, routine immigration enforcement to become routine, as well as going after real bad guys whom we already know about. The federalism issue is important, and the idea that the objection that we don't want to turn cops into immigration agents is a straw man. In no part of the United States today can ordinary cops do their jobs without using immigration law. The prohibition that LA cops, New York cops, Houston, et cetera, have against, they are prohibited by city policy from using immigration law, from making inquiry into immigration status. It's called sanctuary laws, broadly speaking. That impedes the ability of cops to do their regular jobs. So the idea that you can be a city, a jurisdiction, and somehow be aloof from immigration law matters, immigration enforcement, is a fantasy. Cities can do whatever they want on, you know, pass a proposal to boycott companies that do business with Myanmar. I mean, that's just sort of ridiculous posing that, you know, Berkeley and Madison can get away with without any real cost. You can't do that kind of thing on immigration because it has a direct effect on the quality of the life of the people who live there. And as far as the precipitating event, I don't know, I guess you were trying to say if, you know, New York, I mean, if Washington gets nuked or something, will DOD take over immigration issues? Yeah, maybe, but we don't have to let it come to that. And the role the military has now and should have now, the Guard and the Reserve especially, is in backing up the Border Patrol. It's not in mowing down illegals who are coming across the border. It's not even in arresting illegals. It's providing backup, surveillance, transportation, road building, et cetera, assistance to the Border Patrol so that the civilian Border Patrol officers, I mean, the, you know, the non-military, the law enforcement officers in the Border Patrol can then actually do the arrests. That's sort of what they're doing in Arizona, where the born-again border control governor, Democrat Governor Janet Napolitano, has discovered that she's really now in favor of tough immigration control, and not coincidentally, she's up for re-election. Has the National Guard changing tires and that kind of stuff. They can probably be used for more things than that. But there's been a lot of resistance, both at the political level and the military level, even to get, for instance, UAVs, those unmanned aerial vehicles, to drive over the border, fly above the border and do surveillance, which is absurd because Fort Huachuca, which is the head of the Army's unmanned aerial vehicle operation, is right there on the Arizona border. And it's taken a long time to get political permission to use those capabilities for border enforcement, and it really shouldn't have.
Well, thank you for that big bomb of the last question, and thank you all for your careful comments, and thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.